Welcome to Little Atoms on Resonance 104.4 FM, a live talk show about ideas and culture, with an emphasis on ideas of the Enlightenment.
Little Atoms is presented by Neil Denny, Padraig Reedy, Richard Sanderson and Becky Hogg, as well as regular guest presenters.
Little Atoms actively promotes science, freedom of expression, scepticism and secular humanism.
Our guests bring ideas that are challenging, sometimes controversial, often polemical, but always interesting.
Welcome to another edition of Little Atoms, tonight with me, Neil Denny, and I'm joined this evening by Daniel Bohr. Daniel Bohr is a research fellow at the Sackler Centre for Consciousness Science and the Department of Informatics at the University of Sussex. Previously, he spent more than a decade working as a cognitive neuroscientist in the MRC Cognition and Brain Sciences Unit at the University of Cambridge. On this week's show, we'll be discussing Daniel's book, The Ravenous Brain, How the New Science of Consciousness Explains Our Insatiable Search for Meaning. Daniel, welcome to Little Atoms.
Thanks a lot for having me.
I want to talk first of all about your path into neuroscience itself, and you talk at the beginning of the book about witnessing your father's reaction to a stroke he had. So let's talk about that.
Yeah, well, it was actually during my finals, a couple of weeks before my final exams, my father unfortunately had a stroke. And at that time, I was studying both philosophy and psychology, particularly biological psychology. And two of my favourite topics, well, same topic from either half, was consciousness. So on the one hand, there was the philosophy of consciousness and people like René Descartes saying that the mind is independent of the brain. But then on the other hand, there's the science of consciousness that was talking about which bits of the brain are responsible for consciousness. Revising all this for my exams, my father had a stroke, as I said, and so I went to visit him at hospital, and he exhibited a very strange condition, which is actually really quite common for people to have when they have a stroke, at least initially, which involved when I was on the right-hand side of him, we could have a normal conversation, but when I was on the left side, it was as if I didn't exist anymore. He couldn't attend to anything on the left-hand side of space. And there were lots of other aspects of his personality and his consciousness which radically changed as a result of this stroke. So it seemed very clear to me that the philosophers, at least people like René Descartes, were very wrong. And the scientists that were saying that consciousness is a biological process, that the brain generates it, they were the ones that were correct. So that pushed me towards neuroscience and a PhD in neuroscience a year later.
There's always been a debate as to whether consciousness is something that you could even sensibly study with the tool of science, because there has always been this idea that it was somehow separate from the brain and the body, which actually, as you said, when you think that through, that falls apart quite quickly. As you say in the book, if I have a headache, I take an aspirin and the headache goes, and you're aware of the fact that headache goes. So I said that there's a debate about whether or not you could even study consciousness, so let's perhaps talk about some of the stuff that's actually going on now at the Sackler Centre, which is exactly what's going on there.
Right, well, there are lots of ways of studying consciousness. It seems impenetrable, but it's not. There are ways of getting around the apparent impenetrability of consciousness. One way you can explore it is by changing what people are experiencing. For instance, changing from seeing a face to seeing a house. What happens in the brain when your perception changes? And you might think, oh, hold on, the whole of your external world, all the stimuli are changing. But there are various paradigms that you can use where the stimulus is the same, but your experiences switch. So one very common example that some people might be aware of is a sort of ambiguous figure where sometimes you see two people in profile, another time you see a candlestick. You never see all of those things at once. You only see one of those options or the other. You only either see the faces or the candlesticks. So your perception constantly switches. We can put people in the scanner and we can see which bits of the brain actually are changing as their consciousness changes. That's one very common way of looking at it. Another way that I'm involved with at the moment in the Sackler Centre is by attempting to very, very subtly, I should say, interfere with consciousness by a process called transcranial magnetic stimulation. So this involves putting a magnet on the skull of normal volunteers. I've had this done to myself very frequently, and inducing it's an electromagnet. So you induce a current very, very briefly, and that sort of slightly interferes with the neurons in that bit of the brain underneath the skull at that point. So can you interfere with consciousness in certain parts of the brain? So I've been exploring part of the frontal lobes I talk about in the book a lot, the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex. If we use this machine on this part of the brain, can we interfere with consciousness in some way? And some research suggests that we can.
You start the book off with a look at the philosophy of consciousness and what thinkers previously used to think. And it's interesting that you choose this as a jumping off point, because then the rest of the book is actually about the science. So why did you decide to start with the look at the philosophy?
Well, partly out of respect for the history of the subject, because it's mainly been explored philosophically for many centuries, going back to the Greeks. Aristotle, for instance, had a lot to say on this, not in a very sensible way, but René Descartes came along in the early 17th century, and he was an incredibly influential figure in the thought processes around consciousness, the arguments around consciousness. So I felt I couldn't write a book about consciousness without exploring the philosophy, particularly from Descartes, but some modern philosophers that also use similar arguments. And also, other books on consciousness science have largely centered on philosophy. So I wanted to also address what the other books have discussed, but also show how the neuroscience particularly, but generally the science of consciousness, is in some ways superseding the philosophical debates. And philosophy hasn't, to my mind, made very much progress in consciousness studies for centuries. But in terms of the neuroscience of consciousness particularly, but also the psychology of consciousness, we've been studying it in depth for only about two decades, and I believe we've made a huge amount of progress.
So you mentioned right at the top of the interview Descartes and this, you know, the dualism idea, the mind and the body as two separate things. Now, you talk about an experiment that you took part in that really was something that, you know, that proved pretty conclusively that that wasn't true. So tell us about that.
Yeah, so many years ago, a friend of mine, Martin Monti, was trying to perfect a paradigm in the scanner that he was going to apply to vegetative state patients, or patients that appeared to be vegetative, I should say, and see if he could use the scanner to communicate with these patients that may not be vegetative, that may actually have some clear levels of consciousness available to them, but they are paralyzed. They can't show that level of conscious to anyone in the outside world, but maybe they can via their thoughts. So the paradigm we came up with in the lab, which he was spearheading, was where you put someone in the scanner and you ask them to imagine, if they want to answer yes to a question, that they are playing tennis. And we know exactly which bits of the brain are going to activate when they do that, mainly in the motor regions at the top. If they want to,
because you're imagining yourself moving.
When you imagine yourself moving, yeah, that activates the same regions as if you were actually moving, mm-hmm, pretty much. So motor regions for playing tennis, doing forehands and so on. But if you want to answer no to a question, then you imagine you're navigating around your house. So this largely activates parts at the bottom of the brain involved in navigation and scene processing and that kind of thing. So he put me in the scanner as a guinea pig to try and sort of perfect this experiment, and asked me, do I have any siblings? And I imagined playing tennis to answer yes. And few minutes later, as he could very quickly process the fMRI data, he realized that my answer was yes. He said, okay, yes, you have siblings, more than one. And then I imagined navigating around the room for no. And this went on for a while, me answering questions and him knowing what I was answering, not because I was saying anything, but because of brain activity alone. So this was a kind of technological telepathy. So it was a very striking thing. So I am having all these consciousness events, differences in consciousness, as I'm imagining doing various things, and he can decipher them by my brain activity alone. So that to me seemed a very, very clear demonstration that consciousness really is a brain-generated process.
Let's move on from the philosophy to the science then, and I guess I'm going to ask you to do quite a lot in this next question, but let's talk about consciousness from an evolutionary perspective and what benefits it might have bestowed upon us and basically how we came about it, I guess.
Well, just to say one psychological feature of consciousness, which I think most people will be familiar with, to go into the evolution discussion. When we go through life, most of our lives as adults are habitual, pretty much. We just follow habits. When I, for instance, drive my car, I've been driving for over a decade, I can daydream an awful lot. I shouldn't really admit this, maybe, but I can daydream for many minutes on end, on the motorway particularly, and I'm not conscious at all that I'm driving. I'm conscious very much of the thoughts in my head. So it's a very automatic process. On the other hand, if something very unexpected happens, or if I'm really trying to learn some complex new skill, then I'm really conscious of that. So when I was starting to learn driving, I was really conscious of all the processes involved, the gear shifts and everything else. There seems to be something in terms of consciousness that relates it to when we want to learn something complex, learn something new, and particularly, I think, when we want to innovate, when we want to find some new strategy to help us on some complex task that seems otherwise insurmountable in terms of just our repertoire of habits and automatic processes and instincts. So in terms of evolution, it seems to me that consciousness may well have evolved in order to help an animal innovate. And one way it could do that is by drawing together different bits of information to see things in a new way, particularly in terms of deeper patterns to the world. With us, it's totally obvious that we do this all the time in sort of learning all the complex skills we learn. But I think even in simpler animals, if they are conscious at all, the times that they're really conscious that consciousness is required to help them survive is when they're drawing this information together to find some innovative solution out of some apparently insurmountable impasse.
So you link in the book that search for patterns in nature and our environment to the fact that we as humans have, you know, we're always looking for meaning. We're always trying to have a sort of deep-seated need to think of what the meaning of life is and that. So are those two things linked?
I think they're intimately linked, yes.
The obvious question that comes out of that, though, is if consciousness is something that we developed to very quickly learn things, to learn to cope with our environment, to survive, we keep doing that. As human beings, we don't learn things until we're beyond reproductive age, and then basically it's downhill ever. You know, you talk about one way of keeping active is doing Sudoku puzzles and things, but, you know, I imagine I'm going to be doing Sudoku puzzles once I've retired. So it's like we constantly learn new things all through our lives.
Absolutely, yeah. Humans, to me, have an extreme form of consciousness, in some ways an unhealthily extreme form of consciousness. So we just desperately, as I said, but we're ravenous, incredibly hungry for finding these patterns. They help us enormously in life. We control life. We control the world far better than any other species that's ever been. And part of being able to do that is constantly searching, really, really wishing we can find those patterns. There are sort of trivial examples that reflect it, such as loving Sudoku puzzles. There are more disturbing examples to me that reflect it, such as I think the amount of consciousness you have is, in terms of any kind of different species, comparing different species, is related to how superstitious you are as a species. So many, many species have something that appears to be superstition. So even pigeons, for instance.
The B.F. Skinner.
Exactly. Skinner showed that pigeons at least appear to have some kind of superstition. So if he gave them food at regular intervals, and initially when they got food, they would turn around a bit, say. Subsequently, when they get food, in order to get the food, they'd try and do a little dance, going round and round and round. It had nothing to do with when they got the food or not, but it was as if they somehow believed that this elaborate dance would give them the food. Now, humans have astrology, we have alien abductions, we have so many weird superstitions, and I think that reflects our consciousness in a bad way, really. We can't help it. We're constantly searching for patterns. Sometimes we see more patterns than really exist. But it just, again, is another reflection of just how extreme our consciousness is and how extremely hungry we are for patterns.
You're listening to Little Atoms. Today with me, Neil Denny, and I'm talking to Daniel Bohr about his book, The Ravenous Brain. So, Daniel, the book's called The Ravenous Brain, and it's called that because our brains are constantly ravenous for information and new facts and things. But those facts on their own aren't necessarily that useful. You raise a term called chunking to describe what we then do with those facts once we've discovered them. So tell us what you mean by chunking.
Well, chunking is a very profound learning process that humans are exceptionally good at, particularly in terms of using it at various levels. So one example of chunking would be, say I gave you the number to say back to me, 17924612. Would you be able to say that back?
No,
probably
I've already
not.
Forgotten it.
Okay, but if I gave you the number 123234 3456, you probably would find that quite easy.
Yeah, I probably would.
And that's because you'd be chunking it. You'd be finding the pattern, spotting the pattern, and that makes it, instead of 10 digits, it feels much more like just a few digits or even less, because you're able to compress the information and get better at a task. And that's what chunking is at heart. It's about finding some pattern in some information stream, either in terms of its inherent logical or mathematical structure, or because it relates closely to memory, what you've already laid down in memory, and using that pattern to compress the information and make you better at the task. And in humans, it's responsible for very much of our learning. So when we start to learn language, when we say just a single sound, sometimes that can involve the coordination of dozens and dozens of different facial muscles. But eventually, it feels like just one chunk of saying bar or whatever. And then as we start to learn a bit more, we can start combining these sounds together to say a single word. And then eventually when we're adults, if I say, how are you? That is a single chunk to me. So we can build up these layers and layers and layers of strategy, of information. And that makes us understand the world so much better. It makes us much better at interacting with the world, particularly on a layered way. So much of our web of knowledge, subcategories and so on, is due to our chunked learning. So it's an incredibly profound way of learning. It also enables us to be experts at basically anything, including sports and any other kind of skills. And it's one thing that I think particularly distinguishes us from other species. Mm-hmm. So other species can chunk, but even our closest relatives, the chimpanzees, can't chunk on very many levels. Mm-hmm. We can chunk really quite high levels, or four or five different levels up. Chimpanzees are very limited in that way, and I think that really frees us up, these extra levels frees us up to understand the world so much more profoundly and also control it so much more profoundly.
We've been talking about consciousness, and you talk about awareness. What are you talking about when you say the term awareness?
I assume they're the same term. When I use awareness, I'm really, or I use consciousness, they're interchangeable to me. And I think quite a lot of scientists do the same.
You talk about the theories of awareness of a number of neuroscientists, and Victor Lamy and Stanislas Dehaene. So let's perhaps talk about what the current, you know, the most sort of current theories that are out there of awareness stroke consciousness are.
Right, okay. So one thing that's motivated me to write the book, sort of a few years ago when I started writing it, and which particularly excited me, was that the field now seems to be maturing and converging on a set of ideas about what consciousness is. So most of the main theories believe that it's to do with some kind of network structure. Mm-hmm. So the human brain is particularly densely interconnected, for instance, but it doesn't have to be a human brain. So one of the theories, information integration theory by Tononi, is completely ambivalent about what the network could be. It could be a mm-hmm. computer network, for instance. Another aspect is that most of these theories talk about consciousness in terms of a combination of information. So it's all to do with information of a certain kind, particularly when information is combined together. So they all share these sort of common features, but the three main ones that I talk about in the book are all slightly different. So Victor Lamy's recurrent processing model suggests, he tries to say, well, let's ignore the psychology completely. Let's just stick about defining consciousness in terms of the brain. And what he believes is going on is when parts of the brain communicating with other parts, and when there's feedback both ways, that's going to set up consciousness. And it's only going to be a sort of limited kind of consciousness if it's, say, just within the visual regions. But it'll be a sort of a fully fledged consciousness if this sort of to and fro communication also includes the highest, most advanced parts of cortex, which are in the prefrontal cortex and the parietal cortex. I have issues with this theory in terms of saying that the sort of the whole experiential aspect of mm-hmm. it, the psychology of it, is irrelevant. That upsets me somewhat. So I don't really buy into that theory. Stanislas Dehaene's theory is very, very closely empirically driven. So that basically states that this prefrontal parietal network, the set of brain regions that are sort of our most advanced parts of cortex, is where consciousness occurs, and it occurs in terms of, the theory relates it to a particular frequency of brain waves called high gamma, which is the fastest brain waves that we can have. And when something becomes conscious, he talks about an ignition, that suddenly there's a huge spike in activity, particularly or essentially in these prefrontal parietal regions, and then generally representing the conscious information. But at the same time, we have other regions such as areas that process faces or process vision, the specialist areas that provide the specific contents of consciousness. And I think this is a sound theory, but it sticks so close to the actual research, the empirical data, that it isn't so ambitious. It doesn't actually explain too much about what consciousness is. Finally, information integration theory is the most ambitious theory of the day, I'd say, but it's also the most abstract. It doesn't have many details at all about the brain, but it just says that if the network has a particular configuration, particularly in terms of density of connections in that network, and if information is represented in a sort of particularly combining way, then that basically is what consciousness is. And his theory is a mathematical theory, So in theory, you could derive a number for the sort of amount of consciousness in some network or in a brain or whatever. Unfortunately, practically at the moment, you can't actually compute that because there are no computers powerful enough in the world to do it. But there are current theorists that are trying to provide approximations to that theory to make it practicable. And they're sort of, for instance, already being able to use a number to distinguish between when a person is awake and when a person is in anesthesia or deep sleep. So we're sort of converging towards being able to quantify consciousness, if you believe this theory. One of the problems I have with the theory is that it just talking about information on its own doesn't really capture what consciousness is about. If I look at this chair in front of me, I can't help but see it as a chair. It's a very structured piece of information. And that's what I talk an awful lot about in the book, and I think is missing from all these theories, actually.
And you carrying on from that, you mentioned at the beginning of the description of those theories that the concept of the network could be indistinguishable from, you know, any network, like a computer network. But you talk quite a lot in the book about this difference, about how there's the human consciousness is not the same as a computer. There's a thought experiment, which I won't ask you to go into. It's quite complicated, the Chinese Room thought experiment. And again, this is something you talk about in the philosophy part, which is people have often had this discussion as to whether our brain is basically just another computer.
Well, it's not the same as a current computer network, but there's no reason why it can't be the same as a future computer network with the right architecture. So current computers are very serial in nature. One thing goes on to another, goes on to another. Human brains, if you take a neuron, that's on average connected to 7,000 others. So it's an incredibly parallel, interconnected network in the human brain. But if a computer was built on the same lines, it was very, very parallel, and it was sort of simulating a human brain, there's no reason why it couldn't, in principle, be conscious.
I want to take us back to something you said at the last part of the show. You talked about Martin Monti and that experiment that you took part in yourself, and how actually the point of that experiment was eventually to be able to gauge consciousness in people that was in a vegetative state. There's a whole section in the book where you talk about dysfunctional consciousness and like autism and schizophrenia and things. But let's talk about this, the vegetative state, first of all. So how would that then be applied to somebody who was lying in a hospital bed, ostensibly in a vegetative state?
There's a serious problem with patients that appear to be vegetative. So historically, clinicians have diagnosed them as vegetative based on a set of behavioural markers. Do they follow eye contact? Do they respond to commands? But what if, as I said before, a patient is entirely paralysed? So in that situation, the clinician would regard them as completely vegetative, completely lacking in any evidence of consciousness. But they might still be very conscious inside. So what Martin Monti and others have done is put these patients in a scanner and ask them the same questions that I was asked. So similar questions, at least. So what is your wife's name, Marjorie or whatever? And if they, and given them the instructions, if the answer's yes, then imagine playing tennis. If the answer's no, then navigate around your room and so on. And that way, he found that one patient that was officially diagnosed as vegetative could answer the questions. So clearly show, because this is a really quite demanding task, the person was clearly conscious. So that's a really valuable extra piece of information that the clinicians, just from observing the patient, could never get.
Just very, very quickly then, just to finish the show off, you talked about the level of human consciousness obviously is greater than that of animals, but there's a chapter where you talk about levels of consciousness in other animals, and I wanted particularly to talk about crows. The crows are obviously most, already mentioned the chimps, and you know, most people would think of like animals that were more closely related to us, but crows are something that have been studied for their levels of consciousness. Tell us quickly about that.
Well, you could never be certain that any other species apart from us is conscious, because they can't use language to
they
tell
can't
us.
Tell us.
But for things that we ourselves believe would show advanced forms of consciousness, such as recognising oneself in a mirror, using sequences of tools, for instance, the crow family, at least, corvids, has shown clear evidence. So crows, for instance, can use sequences of tools, so one tool to get another, to get another, to get some food, and magpies, another member of the corvid family, have recognised themselves in a mirror. So that provides evidence that they are self-aware. So even birds seem to have advanced forms of consciousness.
Last question then. So what of the future? Will we ever be able to fully understand consciousness, do you think? Do you think that's the direction that the research is going in?
I've been amazed at the amount of progress just in the last 20 years. So I'm extremely hopeful that we will fully understand consciousness at some point. It might not happen in my lifetime, but I'm hopeful that we will actually fully understand consciousness and be able to, for instance, if there was some computer we wanted to know, we'll be able to understand how conscious that computer was, a completely alien being.
That's a good point for us to end. So I've been talking to Daniel Bohr about his book, The Ravenous Brain, How the New Science of Consciousness Explains Our Insatiable Search for Meaning. Daniel, thank you very much for talking to Little Atoms today.
Thanks a lot for having me.
You've been listening to Little Atoms. You can find details of upcoming guests on our website, littleatoms.com. The Little Atoms podcast is available on iTunes. Thanks for listening.